It ain't your mother's book club. It's Chatter on Books. All the wine and none of the angst of book clubs. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer. And here's your host, Tori Clark.
No. Most of the book is about tying knots. Most of the book is about tying knots. Okay, that's the book Moby Dick, which we are going to destroy, and we're going to have banned from public libraries. I'm Tori Clark. It's Chatter on Books. Welcome back for a 50th episode. I have to start giving the numbers, but that's about 48 more than we thought we would ever have, so it's quite an accomplishment.
We should have like a coin or something to commemorate our 50th.
Like actually, a challenge
it's only,
coin.
It's only 40 episodes because 50 is the new 40.
There you go.
I thought I was hoping 60 was the new 40.
60 could be the new 40. Whatever you want.
That's Jamie McIntyre talking, who is our not Bill Curtis.
I'm going to be.
Go ahead. Do you have an intro for the show?
Hello and welcome to Chatter on Books. And here's your host, Tori Clark.
Thank you, not Bill Curtis. That was excellent. Nicely done. We're going to be, since we're failing at new intros for the show, we're going to be seeking inputs from people. They can send them in, right, Claude? People could send in their ideas for intros to the show.
There we go.
And we got Michael Kornheiser and David Aldridge. Claude, of course, the most important person in the room, running the board. And we've got the mayor of Gaithersburg, Judd Ashman, with us. Welcome.
Hello.
Thanks for being here with us.
Thank you for having
me. We have so many things to ask you. And Jamie McIntyre, being a neighbor, has a lot of questions.
Do people really call you your honor?
It depends what mood they're in, honestly.
If they really want something.
Because you haven't considered giving up the title, much like Prince Harry and the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. I recommend you hang on to it. It's a good title.
Yeah, it works.
I'll take that under advisement.
Yeah. We promise to talk about the Gaithersburg Book Festival. We promise to talk about Gaithersburg reading Janine Cumming's great book, American Dirt. But we're going to get the backstory on the mayor. We got some random thoughts for today, which is Martin Luther King Day, which you'll be hearing the show tomorrow, but today is Martin Luther King Day. We have a fabulous, fabulous interview with Claiborne Carson, Dr. Claiborne Carson, which we taped several days ago. Shockingly, he's kind of busy on Martin Luther King Day itself, but he did give us an interview last week, which was terrific, and we're going to do books on civil rights for Deserted Island. First up, Calvert Woodley, our sponsor, God bless them, at 4339 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest. Someone's dinging, or it's the door. Went over there today. Michael Sands was on his way to New York for a Bordeaux tasting. And I said, Michael, here's the difference between your life and my life. You are going to New York for a Bordeaux tasting. I'm cleaning up the yard. But he was out of town. But Bill and Steven in the wine department gave us a French wine. David, what do you think?
I think if Jamie, I have two more glasses of this, it wouldn't be good for anybody. So,
do you know what you like about it? Do you know what you're tasting? I didn't give Jamie the notes.
I don't know. I am not a wine connoisseur. I just know tastes good, doesn't taste good. And this not only tastes good, but it has, it's very smooth.
Okay.
Going down.
That's what they said. It's called a Minervois. I need to learn how to speak French to actually pronounce these. From the Baptiste Boot winery. It gives up lots of berries and spice.
There you go.
According to Bill and Steve. Does that work for you?
That's exactly what I would
say.
Okay.
I would like to say that the wine is, how you say, it is very piquant. I don't know if that's a word in English, but I know that as I drink the wine, the more I drink, the more I like it.
Yeah, amazing how that works. Yeah, the difference between good wine and bad wine, about five bottles.
C'est magnifique.
And then Jeff at La Cheeserie picked to go with it the Drunken Goat. Michael, not our favorite? You can say that.
Yeah,
it's, okay.
It's not my favorite. It's hard for me to find a cheese I don't like.
Yeah.
I think it's the goat.
Okay, so.
You know that like goat stands for greatest of all time, right?
There you go.
I'm sure we got that sports metaphor.
It's Spanish, and it's the Drunken Goat, and Jeff picked it to go with this wine because there's no alcohol in this other than the last stage of fermentation for this cheese is it's soaked in red wine. And so Jeff thought the fruitiness of that would go with the berries of the wine.
I like goat cheese, I think. We had goat cheese last week, and I liked it, I think.
The way you think.
Okay. A couple of randoms. Martin Luther King Day. And, again, Claiborne Carson, really busy today, but we've got a terrific interview coming up with him. I started looking back. I was trying to think about my, relationship with this. And what amazes me about Martin Luther King Day, signed into law by Reagan in 1983. And it took years and years and years before all 50 states actually celebrated it. I think there are two, and I won't name them, but I think there are two who still insist on celebrating it the same day that they celebrate a commemoration of Confederate so-called heroes.
There are still six members of Congress who voted against this bill.
In Arizona, I was working for McCain at the time, and in Arizona it was a very big deal because in 86, Bruce Babbitt, who was a remarkable guy, remarkable family, said, okay, this is it, Martin Luther King Day. And he goes out of office, and he was followed by Evan Meekum, who was a really very controversial, bizarre guy. And Evan Meekum overturned it, and it was years of fighting over a huge controversy.
Yes. But, you know, in virtually every city, every urban area, there's a Martin Luther King Boulevard, street, avenue.
Yeah, Lewis, Delaware everywhere. Just did it. And they got into an argument, I think, over Boulevard versus street, but... Yeah. First recollection of Martin Luther King Day, David.
Oh, I was in college. We were very much engaged in trying to get it made into a national holiday.
The American University.
At the American University. Oh, that was a big, 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 big deal. We wrote several editorials about that. And I remember Bob Dole being, of all people, not, I shouldn't say of all people, Bob Dole, who you would not normally think about this, gave up, got on the floor of the Senate and said, since when is the dollar sign taken the place of the moral code of this country? Because the talk at the time was, well, it's too expensive right. to have this holiday. And that's when I started to think differently about Bob Dole, because I never heard him say anything like that before. But it actually was two or three years before, because it wasn't a holiday and people were pushing for it. And I remember going to a march on the mall where one of the biggest parts of that push to get it made into a federal holiday was that Stevie Wonder wrote a song about Martin Luther King, essentially. It was a birthday song
right.
called Happy right. Birthday, but it's not the Hill Sisters version of Happy Birthday. And it became kind of the anthem, the unofficial anthem of the push to get Dr. King's holiday made into a national holiday. And I was 16, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big deal.
Yeah.
Big deal.
Very big deal. So, Michael, what do they teach in schools these days? Because I think we talked about this last week. When I was growing up in Pittsburgh, I won't say when, because 60 is the new 40, but they weren't teaching us about civil rights. They weren't teaching us about a lot of these things.
Well, I think we need to separate the day from the movement, particularly from mm-hmm. my age group. I'll actually defer to the table here just because I was born after the date. So it's fascinating for me to see this and still understand this as a living, breathing movement rather than the back of a card, which is, you know, I went to our local DCPS. That's what you got. You've got the back of a card. That was basically what fit on half an index card in the Encyclopedia Britannica. And you ended up singing songs and putting on little charades, and there were quizzes, but that was it. So I don't know what they teach, you know, right now. That's what I'm looking forward to seeing, how this is then taught to the boys as they enter mm-hmm. primary school, and then how that's dealt with. Mm-hmm.
So I was a high school student in 1968 at T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, immortalized in the inspiring but historically inaccurate movie, correct. Remember the Titans.
Mm-hmm. Very correct.
And the thing that really struck me was, you know, when I was in high school, during that time, and there were riots in D.C., and then later Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated, we thought, our high school students said that, we thought we were going to be the last generation that had to deal with racism. Because we thought, well, we're being brought up differently than our parents. We're in a school mm-hmm. That's integrated, and we're working together. We had a human relations council. Our homecoming queen was African-American. And we thought, well, this is it. And, you know, this will be the end of going to the school cafeteria and seeing all the black students sitting in one area and all the white students mm-hmm. sitting in the other. And later, as a local TV reporter, I went back to my high school in the 80s and went in. And when I was shocked to discover that when I went into the cafeteria, they were still sitting in separate mm-hmm. areas. And one of the things that, you know, it's just really disappointing is that we haven't made anywhere near the progress that we all thought we were going to make. And I think maybe also we were a bit naive. The thing I remember also is that in the aftermath of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King was, I thought I kind of knew what my black classmates thought about it. And I realized years later, especially when one of them wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post, that I really didn't understand the experience that black students in Alexandria were having in 1968 and 69. I kind of thought I did because I interacted with them at school, but, mm-hmm. but like a lot of white students, I didn't really have black friends outside of school. Mm-hmm. And so it's a little disheartening to look back at that time and think about what we thought was going to be the progress and where we are today.
Mm-hmm. Not giving too much away, but I think Dr. Carson, with the interview which we taped a few days ago, he talked some about that. Yeah. Just say, no, we thought in those years, he, in his life, largely bookended by being at the March on Washington, then the memorial, the statue to Martin Luther King, and the work he's done since then. But he said, look at what hasn't changed. And he talked about how there were feelings along the way. Oh, yeah, now we're past that, and now we're past that. I think when President Obama was elected, a fair number of people said, okay, now we're post-racial. Mm, not really. Not really. Yeah.
No.
I think I'm interested, Michael, in seeing what more and more schools do. It has become a bigger and bigger deal. We have Somerset Elementary right down the street from the undisclosed location, and there are some people in the neighborhood. The neighborhood is still incredibly involved with that school. Some people in the neighborhood say, yes, it's a holiday, but shouldn't we be teaching the kids about it's a day of service? Shouldn't we be teaching kids about? And so they, some people are seen as almost a missed opportunity not to be in school on that day.
It's a, but I totally get that. It's not a day off work. It's a day when we should be on work.
Correct. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, David, you and I talked a few weeks mm-hmm. ago. I said, should we do a show on today or not? It's a Holiday Inn. And you said.
Absolutely. That's what the whole point of it was. Yeah. So we're going to have a choice about what to do.
Yeah. No, okay.
I do think it's. I get, and believe me, I understand that we haven't gone as far as we all thought we were going to go over the last 50 years. But I don't think. We should ignore or we should diminish or belittle the fact that there has been substantial progress made in this country. It's not what I hoped it would be, but it is substantial. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are there are norms now that most, not all, most of our country has come to accept. And again, I think about the children who are growing up and are in school now. If a child is anywhere from 16 or younger, you know, they grew up with an African-American president. That's not
right.
That's not inconsequential. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And that will help. It will help.
Mm-hmm.
It won't solve.
So I just want to build on that point a little bit. I grew up in Miami, Florida. Now I'm in Gaithersburg, greatest city in the world.
That's a lot of people. Miami, Gaithersburg, sure.
But Gaithersburg, one of its distinctions, is it is the second most diverse city in the United States. We've been first before this past year. We were second. Jersey City, we're coming for that title.
Jersey City!
And Miami, Florida was a diverse place as well. But I would argue that we are sort of at the epicenter of progress in a way. We in the DMV, because it's so diverse. And I'll tell you what's different. Because if you go to Miami and say, well, where are the black areas? I could point to neighborhoods. Where are the Nicaraguan areas? Where are the Haitian areas? I could point to neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. But when I came up to D.C. originally and then to Gaithersburg, what was remarkable to me is how integrated everything was. And it's the reason why this is it's been a great place to raise my kids and be for all this time.
How old are your kids?
My kids are now adults, 30 mm-hmm. and 27.
Wow. You must have had them when you were 10.
Thank you.
Wow. Okay. Well, Jamie, how would a real announcer tease the, we've got another thing to talk about, which is the books most checked out from libraries, but how would one tease the upcoming interview with Dr. Carson?
It would be something like this.
I'd hold my ear in a funny way.
I'd put my hand behind my ear and say, don't touch that pause button on this podcast because coming up, an exciting and interesting interview that you won't want to miss. But first, here's Tori Clark.
Perfect. This is awesome.
You think Bill Curtis could have done that?
No. Maybe. No. He'd make some, as Brian says, he would make some, you know, pun on his name, and then we'd have to try to figure that out. No. Okay, from the sublime to the ridiculous, and Michael, I'm coming to you first on this one. books most checked out. I thought of this segment last week. Then I was talking to Ron Charles, the Washington Post book critic, and he was writing about it. And then I saw it on the Today Show this morning. I thought, wow, we have jumped the shark. But the New York Public Library somehow got tons of attention for doing this survey or study on the most frequently checked out books at the public library. I was surprised. It's a ton of kids' books. Michael, over to you.
Why are you surprised by this? Do you not remember when your kids were reading picture books?
But I guess it says who goes to public libraries and the bulk of the people going to public libraries, because I wasn't surprised to see 1984. And there were so many kids' books, though. So is that, and Michael, you're the one taking small children to libraries.
So right now,
are those
Walker's
most of the people
favorite
there?
Activity is going to return books, check new books out, to see the whole process, to interact with the librarians. He checks out the same books every week.
Attaboy.
He checks out books we own. And does not realize. And the worst is when he picks out a book. So he's in a big Thomas the Train phase. And he picks out the Thomas the Train encyclopedia. And every time he reads, he takes a leisurely lunch, 45 minutes to an hour. And he just goes, Dada, read. Mama, read. And you just go, Percy came to the island of Sodor.
Memories.
So it makes total sense that you see this list dominated by those kinds of books. I think there are more questions here to your point as to who's still using the libraries, what communities sort of do they serve, and that's why I love the DC public library system. I love how they've adapted to modern life with the programming they have, whether it's baby lap time, toddler story time, whether it is resume building classes, just a nice place to go do sort of a group project. So I'm not surprised by those. I really liked reading this Ron Charles piece, just as he dives into what Snowy Day represents, because I think that stark contrast of the white on black is really important. And if you remember, one of my goals for this year is just trying to expose our boys to different voices, different faces, different styles. And so much of that for the young readers is just very visual, beyond then looking at how, say, Where the Wild Things completely opens up your mind, or one of the favorite books I love reading to Walker when he goes to bed is Harold and the Purple Crayon. My mom used to read this to me. The copy we have is one that she wrote out to Walkman.
Oh.
And as he's traveling, just clutching the crayon, and you see the moon following him in every single frame. So as far as he goes from home, he always says, Mom, the moon, making sure he doesn't go too far as he finally draws up the covers and goes off to sleep. So no, those don't surprise me. I'm interested in I think it's easy to predict that Fahrenheit 451 would be there, To Kill a Mockingbird, if we think about how timely it always is, the fact that it had the play this year. 1984, Fahrenheit 451, those are the ones that stand out to me. The sort of young fiction of Harry Potter. Again, think about who's going to libraries. You're going to have a lot of kids who are transitioning in the 4, 5, 6. We talk about the fourth grade reading slump, when reading is no longer reading for fun, but reading to learn. And how do you tackle that? So those are the kids who are jumping up fifth grade, sixth grade, trying to get into Harry Potter.
Harry Potter gets extra points on this list because this is the, I don't know how long the public library has been around in New York, a long time, but that's a relatively new book compared to some of the others.
Books have been made the list because they've been checked out for years and years and years. But the Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which, by the way, in England was the Philosopher's Stone.
That's right.
The British version. But you know,
because nobody in the United States would know the word philosopher. Was that the problem?
It's a British thing.
Do you remember the movie The Madness of King George III? Somebody remember? It's actually called The Madness of King George. Wonderful little movie about King George III and the Revolutionary War and whatever. And originally it was called The Madness of King George III. And they did focus groups, of course, when they were making the movie to see what people thought. And this was in the United States. And the morons in the focus group said, I really can't tell you what I think of The Madness of King George III because I didn't see the first two. Anyways, go, Jamie.
So
back to smart people.
My point is that a lot of adults read the hot Harry Potter stuff.
Yes.
Not just a children's book.
Yeah.
In fact, it came up in this Netflix documentary about Aaron Hernandez.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is that good? That's on my list.
It's it could change the way you think about the whole Aaron Hernandez thing, but not to get sidetracked, but one of the books...
Honey, this show is ostensibly about books, but we can go down any path you want.
Because when he's in prison and he's asking his fiance to bring him some books, he wants the Harry Potter books. He loves the Harry Potter books. Huh. And it just shows the appeal that book has, not just to to kids or teenagers. But it's an adult book as well,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which is why it makes a list.
My wife loves Harry Potter books.
I love 1984, and I love Fahrenheit 451. I'm a little sad that two dystopian books were on this list.
Why?
Because I hate dystopian stuff, and Mark should be here to defend it, and no. It's all they teach Michael. They teach a lot of it in high school these days.
I like the Cat in the Hat comes back. In 1984. That's a book a lot of people have
kind of
read.
Michael, why do they teach so much dystopian stuff in high school?
Well, I think we talked about this last year. One, you're trying to read what kids are reading, and so some of the your issue is more with YA dystopian fiction that you think is just pointless sex and violence. And in some ways, you're offering the safe space for teenagers to explore feelings that are happening naturally to them. What I like about Fahrenheit 451 is that it's a very young reader. So you can read it, and they often do in middle school, but you can also read it at a higher level.
Right.
And it is this sort of wonderful scare tactic of what if they started burning all these books?
Right.
Now, have you checked out books in the library recently?
Not since our kids were little, but we used to go to the Bethesda Library.
So now you can check them out digitally, and that's a list that I would love to see accompanying this, because I know in our house when Liz is sitting with the baby and we're feeding Henry and sitting with the napping Walker, we're going through books on our phones. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how Ron Tartles was talking about this a couple weeks ago, how there are only so many digital copies you have access to. And that's a big fight right now with the publishers. Mm-hmm. But you have all these books being checked out that don't necessarily go across the circulation desk. Those are the ones that I want to see what people are reading.
They were not counted in this New York Public Library one. Yeah.
I wonder if the experience is different. If you don't physically have the book, does a child's experience of reading it, because they do read it, but they, I wonder if the experience is different because it's not a physical copy.
So much of, look, I'm not an expert in how children.
You have two children. You're an expert.
Okay.
Guaranteed. Well, it's like Jacques Cousteau got two fish. He was it. That was everything.
If you ever look at their eyes, they're really not always, they don't know where the story is. Right. So much of it is the rhythm of Walker knows when Dada turns the page. Right. I understand these familiar pieces. That's why the Look and Find books are so popular in that encyclopedia book where it's short pieces of text that jump around the page. Obviously, it's the color, it's the movement, but it's how it's the inflection that we add along with the physical process. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do studies about when you think about, so Henry's now, he's beginning to crawl. Six months old, he's beginning to crawl.
He's already crawling.
But when you think about when they do that,
crawling genius.
It's a good sign.
You think about when they do that lift up and you think about, oh my gosh, the way their eyes are to the floor, mm-hmm. that's like this perfect distance of prepping them to learn how to read. And that's so important for their, like the development of their eyes.
You don't have them throwing a baseball yet? Come on, man.
So there are
Walker's
two books
throwing a baseball at everything.
There are two children's books that aren't on this list that I was
And you're sad?
About.
Yeah, go.
Well, I was just surprised. One is the one I think we've all read, our kids, was Goodnight Moon.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And apparently that's because the librarian, the New York City librarian, hated that book. And the other one is Winnie the Pooh.
A.A. Milne's birthday was the other day. And Winnie the Pooh, Ron Charles' favorite childhood book. All of the Winnie the Poohs.
18th of January, which is my wife's birthday, too.
Well, there you go. Did you get her Winnie the Pooh book?
We pulled out the Winnie the Pooh books, and she read me the poem about obedience, which you have to read yourself.
Didn't
like
she
John,
have that in
John,
your
Morrison, some of the debris went to the, you have to read it.
Didn't she have that in your marriage vows too? Okay, so JB, not Bill Kerr, we're now going to take a break and we're going to start talking to Mayor Judd Ashman of Gaithersburg. How would you do that? You'd put your hand behind your ear.
I put my hand
for those
ear.
Watching on News Channel.
I'm sorry, and what was his name again?
Mayor your Judd
John
Ashman.
What?
Your Honor, John. The Honorable
Mr. Mayor.
And now, a Chatter on Books special interview with the mayor of Gaithersburg. Here's Tori Clark.
Thank you, Jamie, not Bill Curtis. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us. So we do want to talk about the Gaithersburg Book Festival. We want to talk about Gaithersburg Reads American Dirt. But a little backstory on you. So we know you're from Miami.
Yes.
What got you to Gaithersburg?
A job brought me up to D.C. originally.
Which job?
It was a family business. It was My stepmother had started a business called the Elegant Envelope, and it was a direct mail firm, but it was very specialized envelope addressing that looked like it was done by hand or by a calligrapher. And so we worked for a lot of the big nonprofits when they want to spend a little bit more to make sure the envelopes got opened. So we were working with the National Gallery and the Smithsonian's and the Georgetown Universities of the world. And that went great for a while. I bought the business from her and went great for a while until it started. The decline started at anthrax. When the anthrax thing hit, people really started to seriously look for alternatives to hard copy mailing. And so I started... It took a few years, but I started a web design development company, and so that's what I'm doing now for my day job. I consider Mayer being sort of my evening job.
It's funny because I thought you were going to say Gaithersburg, America's vacation destination.
We're working on that.
Okay, wait a minute. Your day job and your being mayor is your evening job. There are 70,000 people in Gaithersburg.
Correct.
How is that just – do you never sleep?
Yes, I think the secret is less sleep and less exercise. Oh, that's how that tends to work.
That's not
great. Wow.
But if it felt like work, I wouldn't do it. I mean, it really, most of the time it feels like fun until you get a situation like they had in Chevy Chase with the dog park.
Oh, that was so spectacular.
Yes, it was so spectacular. But
yeah, that was a great story. But now, sometimes on Sunday mornings, I take our dogs over to a dog park over in D.C., near Chevy Chase, D.C., and the Starbucks and things like that.
Don't use up our resources.
Yeah, an interloper. And it's a little crowded.
Call the mayor, Michael.
It's a little crowded now because that dog park was disassembled, as they called it. Isn't that what they said? It was disassembled?
So I love driving by that dog park to this day.
What goes on there now, Michael?
About the stripes? It's still what it was before. It's an open field that people still use to take their dogs.
But there's nothing official about it.
I'm still looking for the unnamed neighbor sipping a glass of Chardonnay at 7 in the morning.
Complaining about the noise. That's right, about the barking. Okay, so what are the big issues as mayor of Gaithersburg? What are your big challenges?
Well, we have a dying mall, Lake Forest Mall. It was the first sort of regional mall in the area, and it's been dying for 2 decades now, and there's been a big challenge with it because while it looks like one property, it's actually 5 properties with a restrictive agreement that none of the owners can do anything without the permission of the other 4. So it's been in stalemate for a long time, and that's the number one priority for the city of Gaithersburg. Right now we're working with a group from South Carolina that's bought part of it and trying to acquire the rest, and we're hopeful they will.
If you have $5 billion like they do in Jersey, you could make it into an amusement park.
Yes,
like
with the ski slope.
Yes, that's what they did with their dying mall.
Yes, you know what? If we had $5 billion, that'd be on the list. That would certainly be on the list.
So when we moved to Gaithersburg, the Lake Forest Mall was thriving. It had an ice rink. It had all kinds of amenities. All the major stores were there. Sure. What do you think is going to happen? What's it going to end up being? Are they going to just end up raising it?
Well, I think it will... This is, look, let's keep this between us, okay?
Completely off the record. No one is listening.
If I had
literally
to guess.
3 people are listening, so you're okay.
If I had to guess, I think Lake Forest will be demolished and it will be redeveloped as some sort of mixed-use neighborhood. That's what I think. And hopefully it will have a very distinctive public space and it will have some really nice public amenities, but I think that's we need that, and we need residential in that area, market-rate residential in that area to help turn it around.
Michael, as the one of the heads of a growing young family, what would it take for you to move to a suburb like Gaithersburg? Because you're a D.C. kid.
I'm not
what do
sure
you want?
If this subject cuts a little close, but trust in the public school system I think would be high up there. Are you embroiled in that as well?
Are you talking about the boundary study?
Yeah.
I'm not as embroiled in it as I once was. And we don't, like at our level, we don't have any control over it. We're just advocates. It's really the Board of Education that controls that. We're aware of it, and we know boundary studies, we want to stay away from them as much as possible. I know people who hate each other 22 years after the last one that was in Gaithersburg. No. Yes. Like, neighborhoods really were pitted against each other. It's tough. And I recognize the problem from both sides. I mean, the school system has this resource. They have room at some of the schools, and they have other schools that are way overcrowded. And so they want to allocate their resource effectively. So I get it from their side, and I get it from the family side, who, like, it's expensive to live in Montgomery County. They've put down all this money. They've done all this research on the school system, and now here you're going to change it? I get it. And that's a tough one.
For those of our listeners outside of the immediate area, for my moving across the D.C. line, I'm entering and paying into some of the best public schools in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. A friend of ours from the show, Gary Braun, he lives beyond Montgomery County, but he has a high school senior and
at
boys.
Gaithersburg High School, by the way.
What? I'll just leave it there then. No, it's been interesting to see how the school age friends grow up together, play on the same soccer teams together. You'd think they are in the neighborhood sort of fold, and then they end up at different schools.
So you go back to the classic movie, Remember the Titans.
Yes.
So this.
What did you say? Wonderful yet historically inaccurate.
Inspiring.
It was
inspiring.
It was actual movie.
But yeah,
actual,
I want it to be accurate.
There, you know, it was
the event in Alexandria
up.
In 1971, which the date the movie was, are very much playing out again today, particularly in Howard County, which is the next county over. Which is that people want to go to their neighborhood schools, but we have this problem with you need to increase the diversity and the way they solved it in Alexandria, by the way, and the reason that the T.C. Williams team won the state championship, as depicted in the movie, is that in Alexandria, which at the time was a city of 100,000 people, they simply decided that everybody would go to the same high school. Therefore, it would be perfectly representative of the city because there's only one high school, and they combined three varsity teams and they won the state championship, which they never did again. And we're seeing the same thing play out in Howard County, where we have neighborhoods that are predominantly white, and we have neighborhoods that are more diverse, and they're trying to balance this. And the one thing that you discovered, and this was the case back in the 70s, and it's the case today, is people, it's not necessarily a racial thing, but they want to go to schools in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
And so reconciling these two conflicting goals is a very thorny problem. Mm-hmm. But I defer to you, Mr. Mayor.
He's got it.
And again, in Montgomery County, it's a county problem. It's not it's not a Gaithersburg problem.
Yeah. Let me just say one more thing before we... We want to get on to the book festival and other stuff, but in terms of the different... Like, if you're in Montgomery County, you're a parent, and you're thinking that your kids are going to be boundary to a different school, the difference between... a good school and a bad school in Montgomery County is the difference between a Mercedes and a BMW.
Yeah, right.
They all have the same curriculum. The schools that have the lower test scores tend to be the ones that it correlates very highly with mobility rate. People, you know, where there's renters and people are moving in and out during the school year. And also ESOL, where there's a high percentage of people where English is their second language. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the curriculum, the quality of instruction, the quality of teachers and administration, there's essentially no difference. And probably the lower test score schools are your kids are going to get more attention and even better education.
Yeah.
Can I just say my son went to Gaithersburg High School and he got an excellent education.
Yeah.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. And timing's everything. Our kids went to Somerset Elementary down the school, which is a fabulous school. And while they were there, and when they were graduating fifth grade, I said, oh, I wish this school went to 12th grade. Fabulous. The middle school at the time just had some problems. They had some turnover. They had just had some problems. It was not the place for our wonderful son, Colin, the oldest one, to go. And so that's why we switched out. But BCC, fabulous. I had a little fight the other night, though. Did you hear about that? BCC and Walt Whitman. Kids got at it in a basketball game the other night.
Really?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There were some...
Exactly. Sold it under the highway, did they?
It sounded
like...
it's
neutral territory.
It sounded like...
Hey, I'm going to make nice with them. I'm only going to challenge it.
Great, daddy-o.
So, you know, just completely off the subject, do you know in the latest version of West Side Story, they've eliminated one iconic thing?
That's the show.
Not in the latest version.
I'm not sure I want to see it.
Anyway.
That should be the title of this show. How do I don't know.
Boy.
Yeah.
Boy.
Get loose, boy.
Okay. It's perfect. The reason the mayor is here, the many reasons the mayor is here. So you're busy. You had the day job. You had your stepmother's company. You're the founder of the Gaithersburg Book Festival.
Correct.
How did it come about? What was the inspiration? It's the biggest outdoor?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for saying that, Tori.
I do my research.
Yes, since the National Book Festival moved indoors to the convention center, we are the largest outdoor book event in the DMV. How did it come about? Well, I like to think that in my blood, growing up in Miami, where they have the Miami Book Fair, started by my idol, Mitch Kaplan, it sort of started, like the idea germinated there. But there was, so you know, for the National Book Festival, the founder was Laura Bush and the Librarian of Congress, James Billington.
Yeah.
And in 08, so that's a fall event. In 08, the election was going on, but they didn't know who, obviously, they didn't know what administration was going to come in or whether they would continue the event. And so I remember sitting in the audience. I was watching whatever author, and Billington came on stage, and he just encouraged the audience. Whoever comes in, please write them letters to continue the National Book Festival. And I remember driving away in my car thinking, if they were to cancel this event, this was to die, it would be such a shame. It's such an amazing cultural opportunity for people. Then I thought, I had been a city council member for a year at that point, and I thought, well, why couldn't we do one of our own? There's so many amazing authors and journalists and educators, and within an hour's drive of Gaithersburg, why couldn't we do it? They come, they speak, they sign books, they're done in 3 hours, they go home and have dinner with the family. Not a big deal. So I, as the idea sort of continued to evolve, I thought, well, you know, not only are we, could we continue this, but we could also sort of build Gaithersburg's brand around a cultural thing. And that has, you know, anyway, I brought the idea to my, city council and to my mayor at the time. And I'm not sure they fully grasped the, you know, how big the idea was, but they were all, okay, let's do it. Let's try.
Sure. Books don't hurt anybody.
Yeah. So we, that was 08 and 09. I started planning it with a committee, including Becky, who's here watching from the side here.
Brought awesome chocolate and some other stuff. Thank you, Becky.
Yeah. And Becky has,
go blue.
Becky has become our, lead author, adult author recruiter for the book festival for the last 11 years. So we started planning. It took 14 months. We launched our first book festival in 2010, and we had 6,000 attendees. It was largely because we had some amazing authors sign on at the beginning. Alice McDermott, who was just tremendously supportive. Friend of the Kornheiser Show, John Feinstein, came. He was a big
friend. Interesting term to use.
Well, yeah. Maybe a former friend. I don't know where that stands. I know
this. FF.
Right answer.
Yeah, there are things. Anyway, so it started off really with a focus on DMV sort of talent.
Sure, and there's as we know, there's a ton of talent in the DMV. A
ton of talent. It's been wonderful. So it started there, but then it grew to a much more sort of national thing. And so, you know, at the beginning, we didn't know what we were doing. It was I remember
ignorance is a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Naivete. It was. Yeah. It worked to my advantage. I remember calling Random House one day, like early in spring '09, and just saying, "I'd like to talk to a publicist." And they're like, "Well, which one?" And
we have 9,000.
You know what imprint? And I was like, "Well, what's an imprint?" You know, I had no idea. So it was silence, and I just said, well, what's the best one? Who do I want to talk to? And I got nowhere. But eventually, we learned what we were doing, and now we're at the point where the publishers are coming to us and pitching us authors each year, which is wonderful, and it's grown. Now we've had our record is 23,000 attendees.
That's fantastic.
23,000.
And who's going to be on your agenda on May 16th?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I actually brought somewhat of a cheat sheet. We're still in the author recruitment period of time, but there are a few highlights I'll bring up. We got Maria Russo, who is the New York Times children's book editor, How to Raise a Reader. Perhaps Michael.
Yeah.
He's not going to have any trouble raising readers, but Linda Sue Park, another children's author, winner of the Newbery Medal, wonderful writer. M.T. Anderson, a graphic novelist, winner of the L.A. Times Book Prize, finalist for the National Book Award. Susan Hennessy, who some people may recognize from Wolf Blitzer's show every day. She's always talking about Trump on there. She's got a book about called Unmasking the Presidency. A lady named Casey Sepp, I just started reading this book last night. It's called Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. Have you guys heard of this one?
Oh, I've heard about this, yeah.
This was on Obama's list, best of the year. And she's a writer for The New Yorker, and she's coming to talk about that book. The paperback version is coming out. I started reading it. It seems great. A friend of this show, Sarah Pekkanen, who's also a very early supporter of our book festival. Feinstein will be there. I don't want to get
everywhere.
Political here.
He's everywhere.
For those,
is it another Final Four mystery? Is that what it is?
Not this one, but he has been at our festival for a Final Four mystery.
I say all the time, my kids loved his books.
Kids love his books.
Yes.
You know, I keep thinking when I hear Michael talk on this show and on the Kornheiser about golf, I keep thinking, when is he going to write his like master's mystery? When is that going to happen?
No pressure, Michael.
I think murder at the end.
Literally laughing right now.
So you guys mentioned, we talked about progress, and I know we had the event in Charlottesville from a few years ago on our mind. Michael Signer, who was the mayor of Charlottesville at that time, has book out. He's going to be at our festival. David Ignatius from The Post, Ruth Marcus from The Post. And then a couple interesting ones that you might not know of. George Zidane, he's a science writer and sometimes TV personality. His book is called Ingredients, The Strange Chemistry of What We Put in Us and on Us.
Don't want to know it.
You know what? I might be with you.
Yeah, don't want to know.
I might skip that presentation. And then Mary Norris, who's been the copy editor at The New Yorker for like 40 years. She calls herself the comma queen.
Yes. I want her on this show. That book sounds fascinating.
Maybe we can help. Maybe we can help.
Is this the Oxford comma dilemma that's going on?
Well, that's...
There is no dilemma. The Oxford comma is perfectly fine.
No, it's
yes, we agree.
Yeah, it's a lot about editing all the stuff over the years. Yeah,
it's a song.
Yeah.
And kind of why grammar matters, but it sounded absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And we hope to tape Chatter on Books at the festival.
I am looking forward to that.
There we go.
It's going to be great to have you guys
absolutely
there.
Yeah,
it'll be fabulous.
Sounds like an off-the-ball question. So you shared with us these lovely bookmarks, and I'm a huge fan of bookmarks. I love stores that have their own branded ones, different colors. Thank you, Browse About Books. So the Book Festival of Gaithersburg, May 16, 2020. You talk about the national book festival that we remember on the mall. Do you guys have branded posters? Because the best part about that festival was collecting the posters, and it's such inside artwork. Is that...
We do not, but we would like to. You know, I kind of want to take your dad's cue and make a call here on this podcast for people who want to
just imagine
donate
the exposure.
This work. Imagine the exposure.
Now, there's got to be a way you can work with some high school kids, student groups to just help them build that out.
I'm open to ideas. So
Google National Book Festival posters.
They're great.
They're beautiful.
Yeah.
Amazing. They're amazing.
That'd be a fun coffee table book.
Absolutely.
Right? Or a poster?
Oh, yeah.
That's
except
a good one.
They are irregularly sized, so it's impossible to go out and get like just your general poster frame to put them. So sometimes they just sit in a nursery for 2.5 years, rolled up in a corner.
Yeah, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Maybe. Some hypothetical nursery. Okay, between now and then, though, you have something fabulous going in Gaithersburg.
Yeah, something we've never tried before. My team goes to Book Expo America each year after a book festival. It usually takes place in early June. Mm-hmm. And which, for those of you who don't know, it's the biggest trade show within the book industry each year. And every year there's like a couple of the sort of the most buzzed about books. Mm-hmm. And it turned out at the most recent Book Expo, the most buzzed about book was this book called American Dirt by Janine Cummins. Now, when Becky, my adult author recruiter, came back from Book Expo and she says to me, Janine is the belle of the ball at Book Expo. I said, okay, we're going to have to do something special. Now,
and she can refer to Janine by first name because...
Because Janine has been at our festival before. She is a daughter of the city of Gaithersburg. Yay. She is a graduate of Gaithersburg High School. And she graduated from Gaithersburg High School, went to college, moved to New York to become a world-famous author, work in the publishing industry. And as of tomorrow or today when you're listening to this, January 21st, she is about to become a household name with this book. For News Channel 8,
there you go.
This is the book.
American Dirt.
American Dirt. And this is, when I say it's the most buzzed about book.
People have been talking about it for months.
Yeah. It's like the number one indie next pick for February. It's the Amazon book of the month. It's on the lists of the most anticipated books of the New York Times, the Washington Post, Oprah, Vogue, Entertainment Weekly, and I can go on.
John Grisham, Stephen King, people of that ilk have been saying, this is one of the greatest things I've read.
Stephen King's blurb on it was, I defy anyone to read the first 7 pages of this book and not finish it.
Can you hold it up to the microphone again so we can get a close-up?
Well done. So, to just give you a little background on the book, there are no spoilers here. Yeah. Everything I'm going to tell you is like on the first couple pages. This is a story of a lady, a Mexican mother of an 8-year-old, and they are at a quinceañera for her niece. And her 8-year-old son has to use the restroom, and he's taking a while, and she goes to check on him. And at that very moment, sicarios from the drug cartel come and assassinate the entire family. And they're looking for the mom as well, but they don't find her. She's not where they expect her. The rest of the book is a procedural on how to escape Mexico and the tentacles of the cartel. She doesn't feel safe using her car. She feels like it's wired. She can't use her credit card. So essentially, she has to take the same trip that migrants take through Mexico to get to America all the time. The author I know went and researched this very heavily. So it's kind of like a suspense novel. It's kind of, there are some horrifying elements to it.
Right.
It is a page turner, but it is also a very literary element to it as well. So it's a fantastic book.
And you've chosen it to be Gaithersburg Reads.
Yes.
Which is your community-wide book club.
Yeah, we've never done this. We've had the book festival before, obviously 10 times right. before, and we've had ancillary events before, but we've never tried to get all the community to read a book and then get together for a book discussion, like a giant book club with the author. And so
you're going to need a lot of wine.
You might have to help with that. Yeah. As mayor, there's something.
Calvin Woodley will come across the border, I'm sure. Yeah. So how do people participate? How do people from the DMV participate?
So first off, you want to learn about this and everything about the Gaithersburg Book Festival, go to GaithersburgBookFestival.org. You want to participate in this, I recommend get the book, read the book, and then March 31st at Gaithersburg High School in their auditorium, we're going to have an event with Janine, and we're also going to have another special guest who will be amazing and will be announcing in another month or so.
Excellent.
It's going to be a fantastic, fantastic event. We'll discuss the book. She'll sign your books. It'll be wonderful.
Seems like a wonderful person. I've read a lot about her. I've heard about the book even before you and I started trading emails, Mr. Mayor, and you've never heard the kind of pre-buzz for a book the way you've heard from this, and you've never seen people of the level of the Stephen Kings, the John Grishams, going out of their way to say,
yes,
this is fabulous. There's no reason for them to support this and support her other than they think it's a fabulous book. So it's great that you have her, and it's great that she's from Gaithersburg.
It's such a wonderful opportunity for us. Yeah. And, you know, Gaithersburg being a city where roughly a third of our residents were born in a country other than the United States and have their own immigrant stories, I think it's going to resonate in many ways.
Yeah. Happy ending?
Don't give it away.
Am I allowed to say?
No, Tori? Don't.
They're
okay. Okay.
Be upset.
Don't give it away.
Yeah, don't give it away. Okay.
It ends. That's all you need to know.
That's right. So, Jamie, not Bill Curtis. Now we're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back with Deserted Island. How do we do that? Once you finish your drunken goat cheese.
Stand by as we take a quick pause.
Wait, I'm wrong. Claude, I'm wrong, right?
What?
This, I'm so confused because we're taping. We're doing this. We back up. Back up.
Never mind.
Never mind. Back up. I got up.
Okay. No,
I'm so confused because we have never done this before.
Please stand by. Stand by. Adjustment to your set is necessary. You're experiencing technical difficulties.
So now we're going to go to our interview with Dr. Claiborne Carson, which I think I teed up pretty well at the beginning of the interview, but I'll do it anyhow. He's an amazing guy, an author, historian. Life largely bookended. He was at the March on Washington in 1963. He was integral to the statue of Martin Luther King being placed down on the Tidal Basin. He was tapped by Coretta Scott King to pull together all of Martin Luther King Jr.'s papers to create the autobiography and then several other books. An incredible guy. And so we will be very lucky to have him and listen to this interview. Let's start at the beginning, if we can. Almost 60 years ago, you were a 19-year-old at the March on Washington. Is that right?
Yes.
And you were not, and I speak far too colloquially, so I apologize for that, but you were not a Martin Luther King guy. You were a Bob Moses guy, right?
Well, when I went to the March on Washington, I was a 19-year-old kid who didn't know anything about the movement. Mm-hmm. And it just... I was just learning. I was just finished my first year of college, and I became so familiar with people in the movement. And it happened that I was invited to go to a conference in Indiana, at the University of Indiana. And kind of in my naive way of growing up in New Mexico, where our baseball team would travel several hundred miles to play a baseball game, I thought, pretty close to the march. And
halfway there.
I'm halfway there. And if I was able to get a ride, I would go. And so I was able to finagle hitch a ride with a group from Indianapolis. And they left the night before, and I got there the morning of the march. So it was in part happenstance, and that was the first civil rights event that I had ever attended. So it was a great way to start my career as an activist, to start with. I kind of thought that maybe everything in the movement would be like that. And I quickly found out that most marches have nothing to do with 200,000 people. They're much smaller events.
What was the impact on you that day, though? And Martin Luther King was at the end of a very long day of speeches, right?
Yeah.
Were you still listening by the end of the day? I know if I were hanging out with a lot of my friends by the end of the day, I might not be listening too much.
What I remember is I was definitely interested in finding my right home. And so by the time he had finished his remarks, I was moving away from the stage. So, because I realized that there would be several hundred thousand people all looking for their rides. And I had to be sure that I got to mine. And it turned out I didn't. I did not find my ride home, and hitched a ride with a group from New York. So but that was my concern at the very end was, everyone wanted to stay for Martin Luther King's speech. And that's why, one of the reasons why he was the final speaker is that no one wanted to follow him.
Sure.
Because if whoever had gotten up after him would have seen the audience very rapidly moving away. And so everyone there kind of had the same idea that I had. Yes, we wanted to listen to him, but as soon as he's finished, we want to be searching for our rides home.
And had you told your parents where you were going? Did they even know?
No, I did not. You've got to remember that at the time there was this idea that this is after Birmingham. So there's the notion that if there's a protest, there might be violence.
Right.
And I found out later that there was actually preparations, that there were troops in Washington just in case it got out of hand. And so I would not have told my parents that that I'm going. They would have worried. In fact, even after I got back, I didn't tell them for a lot of years, and they probably figured it out along the way. But I did tell my siblings, and
That's fascinating.
And but I just did not want them to worry.
I am so curious about how a young person makes decisions in the 1960s, especially a young person of color, because I was 19 and black, and good Lord knows I could not have possibly made any type of rational or smart decision about what I wanted to do in the world. So what was your kind of process by which you ingested all of this information that was coming to you at the time? You know, you not only have Dr. King's movement, you have Malcolm's movement, you have Bob Moses and SNCC, you have all of these people talking about the same thing in different ways, almost like the blind man and the elephant, right? So how do you process that to make good decisions about where you're going to spend your time and what causes are going to be the most important to you?
I'm kind of laughing when you say good decisions as a 19-year-old. I mean, it's almost like a contradiction in terms that, you know, you're at 19, you think you're going to live forever.
Yeah.
You know, I ended up, as I said, I did not find my ride. So I ended up with very little money in my pocket, going to New York, switching my bus ticket from Indiana back to New Mexico for a ticket from New York to Indiana. And I got off the bus in Indiana and I had no way home. I hitchhiked across the country. So that is definitely not a decision that I would call a good decision for a 19-year-old black kid to be right. Hitchhiking across the country in 1963.
Right.
And, you know, lots of bad things could have happened to me. And fortunately, I found decent people who picked me up and got me along the way. And it actually didn't take that long to get back. So I think maybe the strangeness of seeing a young black kid hitching in 1963 through the middle of the country was the people who picked me up. We better pick this kid up because he might be killed.
Right.
And we might be saving his life by giving him a ride someplace. You never know about these things. And
you never,
I think,
would you ever have expected?
I think one of the things about it is I would just add is that for me, it was the first really independent, risky decision I had made in my life.
Yeah.
And so I kind of made maybe a childish decision, but I also became an adult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I realized that it was my life. And, you know, there were choices that you make and adventures you want to have. And so it's probably not that different from deciding to, you know, climb a mountain and, you know, do other things that might involve risk. And saying in this particular case, it was something I really wanted to do and I've never regretted it. It opened up a new door to my life. I thought, you know, would I be doing what I'm doing right now if I had not made that decision? If I had not met Stokely Carmichael and, you know, these amazing people, Bob Moses and, you know, all the things that came out of that decision. So I think that, it was the beginning of another stage in my life. And I'm sure that my entire life would have been different if I had made a different decision.
But for a bus ticket. So
yeah.
you did choose a path with Bob Moses and SNCC. You wrote your thesis about SNCC, I believe. So how unusual, how unexpected was it when you got a call saying Coretta Scott King wants you to edit and pull together all of Martin Luther King Jr.'s papers and write the autobiography? Were you surprised?
I was surprised, yes, because that had not been my expertise. I think that the reason why she called is that she had heard that I had really was a young scholar who had done work on the movement. And at least I wouldn't be coming with
no knowledge of what I was taking on. But after that first phone call, I said, you know, I thought that there would be other people who might be better qualified, who had written maybe a biography of King or something like that. And but one thing I learned about her from that first phone call, she was pretty persistent. You know, she had made the decision that I was the person she wanted. She had talked with John Hope Franklin, a very prominent black historian of that period, and he had recommended me. And so I think once she made the call, she really wanted to convince me to do it. And she was coming out to California, to San Francisco. And she said, well, you know, look, I'm going to be doing a fundraising tour out there. And why don't we get together? And I think one of the things I'm smiling right now, because when I told my wife that Mrs. King had called and I had turned her down, she was upset with me because she said, you know, Clay, you'll be looking over your shoulder for the rest of your life saying, I was asked to edit Martin Luther King's papers and I turned it down.
Smart lady.
And and I, she's often makes better decisions than I make. And so I sat down and wrote her a note just saying, you know, I'd seriously consider it and if we could work out a way so that I didn't have to move to Atlanta, that maybe it could work.
And she was heavily involved, right? In the autobiography for sure, but all of the works you now had of Martin Luther King Institute. Go ahead.
For that purpose, she was my boss. She was the one who could fire me, and sometimes I think she wanted to. she was definitely in charge of this project, and I worked. Now, I insisted that I work on the project not as a direct employee of the King Center, but as an employee of Stanford working on a research project, and that some of the work would be done at Stanford. Mm-hmm. I spent the next 10 years doing a lot of commuting to Atlanta. But I certainly don't have any regrets. I think that it's been a tremendous experience to first spend the first part of my career looking at the movement from the grassroots up, and the last three decades looking at it from King's perspective, and seeing, getting a realistic notion that combines both of those perspectives.
Yeah, I've seen you. I've seen some of your writing. I've heard you do some interviews in which you talk about you think King's years after 1965 were the most interesting, or most interesting to you. Why is that?
Well, I think that the more I learned about him, and we started to do the King papers chronologically, the more I learned about him, I realized that his vision was always much broader than simply civil rights. Mm-hmm. He probably would not have become a civil rights leader if he had not been in Montgomery when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat. Mm-hmm. But if he had gone to another southern city, he would not have been thrust into that role of civil rights leadership. But he would have been a leader in other ways. He talks in 1948 about what his mission as a minister will be, and he says, my job is to deal with what he calls the social gospel, to deal with unemployment, slums, economic insecurity. So he would be the type of minister who would set up a place where poor people could get food and clothing and stuff like that. And, you know, I know ministers like that. Mm-hmm. That's what he set out to do in 1948. But in my view, he, because of Rosa Parks, there was a detour in his life. And for about 10 years, he's playing the role of a civil rights leader. But in 1965, that agenda is pretty well complete. You know, he gets the Voting Rights Bill passed. And so immediately you see him going back to his original agenda.
So if you look at his life in its totality, not just those 10 years, but his entire adult life, he's doing the same thing in 1968 that he said he was going to do in 1948. He's dealing with poverty, unemployment, slums. He's leading a poor people's campaign. He's going to Chicago rather than dealing in the, with the South. He's kind of an accidental civil rights leader.
Yeah, and he was criticized for some of it, right? And been you, but your admiration for him seemed to have grown or become deeper when he was criticized for getting away from the vision of the civil rights. These are my words, so tell me what I'm getting wrong. But criticized for getting away from the primary vision of the civil rights movement and going into these other areas. But your admiration for him, I can't separate you and your career from him. Your admiration for him seems to have grown when he did go into those other areas.
Well, I think it's not just an admiration. Yeah, he did a wonderful job as a civil rights leader. But it's more that an understanding of him. You know, when he gives his speech attacking the war in Vietnam, he knows that he's going to be attacked by people saying, why are you a civil rights leader speaking out against the war? So he begins the speech by saying, some of you have not really understood me. You know, the depth of my passion about these other issues. And so for him, he's going back to his roots. He's going back and saying, I have to speak out against the war because I'm concerned about the diversion of resources from the war against poverty to the war in Vietnam. You know, he saw that Lyndon Johnson had launched this, you know, war against poverty, but it was actually, as he put it, a minor skirmish against poverty. The war was against the Vietnamese, who he saw as the enemy, right. Lyndon Johnson saw as the enemy. And so if you go back to his speech, what it is an attack on the priorities that have resulted in this diversion of resources to war. And, you know, that's the part that I think has the most continuing relevance, because we still spend vastly more money, trillions of dollars, fighting wars, while we are hesitant to spend anywhere near that amount on education, on anti-poverty aspects of, you know, the gulf between the rich and the poor. You know, that I think if he were alive today, he would be saying, just imagine what we could do with just a small fraction of what we spend on the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. If just a fraction of that could be diverted to making our schools better, especially in poor neighborhoods, you know, that would have much larger impact and a much better set of priorities for the nation.
I am so fascinated by your notion that his fight would be very relevant today, because I am fascinated and always have been fascinated by the time he spent in Chicago in 66 and 67 and the virulence of the hatred against him, which he said was much worse than what he experienced in the South. You know, the counter protests that were going on in Skokie and other places, other suburbs at the time. But the relevant thing to me is just, I'm just fascinated by the idea that what he was fighting for then in 1966 was trying to get the minimum wage raised to $2 an hour, which is the exact equivalent of $15 an hour today. And it just fascinates me that we've come full circle in 50 years.
He was also calling for a guaranteed annual income, and that idea is kind of resurfaced, you know, some 60 years later.
Right.
And, I think that the questions that he raises during the last years of his life, you know, it's easy to praise the civil rights speeches, because
Those succeeded. We passed civil rights legislation. Now, I think he would have wanted stronger civil rights legislation, and we've kind of backtracked on that. But I think that the speeches he gives in Chicago and afterwards, his last book, Where Do We Go From Here? Mm-hmm. You know, that we haven't answered that question. He was really saying, now that we have achieved civil rights reform, what do we do next? And I don't think we've given him an answer. Hmm. You know, we don't seem to know where to go next. What is the next large set of battles in the effort to achieve a more just and peaceful world? You know, how are we going to get to that next stage?
If we don't have the answers to those questions, do you see the people in public life today that could at least take us down those paths?
I think it takes visionaries to kind of have a sense that, well, what's the next stage? Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about the anti-slavery struggle, that in the late 18th century, if someone had said, you know, my goal is to eliminate slavery everywhere in the world, to make it illegal everywhere, most people would have said, you're crazy. You know, that there's every major civilized nation in the world has some form of slavery, indentured servitude or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. There's some way of getting people to work for nothing and force them to do it. And yet, 100 years later, it became illegal everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. Now, what is the equivalent today? I mean, I think we did have this long effort to bring about civil rights reform. It didn't happened just in the 60s. You know, the NAACP was formed in 1909. Right. So that's another 100-year struggle, you know, where mm-hmm. you're trying to realize the promise of the 14th and 15th Amendments to the American Constitution. And 100 years later, we kind of got some legislation that put some reality to that ideal of, you know, the 14th Amendment sounds really nice. The 15th Amendment, you know, guarantees every person the right to vote. And the 14th Amendment says everyone is a citizen of the United States who lives in, and is born in the United States. But it's taken 100 years to make that real. Mm-hmm. And we're still working on it. So,
does your work make you optimistic?
In the long run, you know, as King says, as King says, that the moral arm of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Right.
And I think he could add, but all of us will be dead by then. So.
All right. Well, in the meantime, let me get you out on this. So there are so many things, so many books, so many wonderful things that you've brought to life. There's the autobiography. There's A Call to Conscience, Martin's Dream. The encyclopedia, if we were advising 20-somethings, teenage kids, whatever, for whom 1968 seems like ancient history, here's a place to start. Where would you advise them to start?
I would advise them to try to recognize the social justice, human rights movements that are going around around them. Mm-hmm. You know, if I hadn't gone to the march in 1963, I might have been... What's the story of Rip Van Winkle about, King gave a sermon about the idea that someone falling asleep and missing the revolution.
Right.
And I think many of us are asleep. Hmm. You know, we don't see that, I have to correct my students when they say back in civil rights days. Exactly when civil rights days ended, can you tell me that?
Right.
You know, isn't Black Lives Matter a civil rights movement?
Right.
Aren't we still dealing with civil rights? These are not struggles that have ends. You know, that the notion of human rights that is written into our Declaration of Independence. You know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and you know, these inalienable rights.
Oh,
we're still working on that.
I promise. Last story, because I did not know this. I've been to the, you know, your life in some ways bookended. The March in 63, you were integral to the statue of Martin Luther King, the monument to Martin Luther King being put up on the Tidal Basin. I didn't realize why it faces the way it faces. Can you tell us that story? And then I promise I'll let you go, because your assistant's going to kill me if we keep you much longer.
Yeah. The original idea was to have him facing his statue, facing the Jefferson Memorial, because Jefferson had written those words.
Those words.
You know, his,
yeah.
Those words. So I imagined Martin Luther King having this symbolic dialogue with Jefferson, saying, "You wrote those words. Now we're still trying to make those words real."
Mm-hmm.
And having this dialogue across the ages, you know, of that's the great dialogue of American history.
Yeah.
Of how a country could put forward a human rights ideal as its rationale for existence, at the same time the people writing that are slaveholders, some of them were. And Jefferson is being called to account for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and you're owning slaves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and we create a nation that takes away life legitimately. That's one of the things that nations prioritize, is how to kill people.
Mm-hmm.
And the pursuit of happiness, we give it a lot more to some than to others. So that ideal of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness as being the birthright of every human being, we created a nation that contradicts that every single day. So that's the great American dialogue of that's what King is talking about at the March in Washington. How do you make these ideals real in the 21st century?
Right. Well, Dr. Carson, you've kept that dialogue front and center for so many people with your work. So again, it's just an honor to talk with you. You have a standing offer to come and talk with us anytime you want, Martin Luther King Day or not, or beyond.
Exactly.
But in the meantime, I hope you have a great day, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Chatter on Books now continues. Here's your host, Tori Clark.
Thank you, Bill Curtis. And thank you, Dr. Carson. Okay. David snorted.
I just actually snorted.
Wow.
I can't believe I just did that.
We just had an interview with the head of the Martin Luther King Institute, but that's okay.
Hey, okay. Sorry.
But in honor of the day, Deserted Island can't be about anything other than this, and that is books on civil rights.
Yes.
Michael, would you like to go first?
I can go first. I think I took this in a different direction, but...
Would we expect anything less?
Part of this is, I was thinking about this over the weekend, part of this is because of my age, mm-hmm. because of other of my identifiers, but, you know, I meant when I said earlier that one of my issues growing up at my local DCPS was that this was something that was taught on the back of that sort of
right.
postcard, and we were talking about how much progress has been made. We listened to Dr. Claiborne's interview and sort of some of the shortcomings, and I'm embarrassed that in high school, a lot of my very well intentions friends would say, well, we are the generation that grew up in a post-color world. Friends would just say, I don't see color. I just see people.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that's just not true. So I was thinking back to a book, a collection of short stories. I was thinking about the last year and a half on the show, the 50 episodes. And I was thinking about a small collection of short stories called Always Outnumbered, Always Outgunned, that looked at an older African-American man trying to find his way in the world during the race riots in LA. And I was then thinking about a book. You know, one of my goals, I was trying to find more voices, not just for the boys, but for myself.
Right.
So I'm excited because I think you guys are going to share a lot of nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my goals. And I'd like mm-hmm. to open myself up for that. But this is a book that I remember reading about last year and I purchased it. I have not read it yet. But my understanding is that this is a collection of short stories looking at a group of young African-American men. And I wanted to see what their experience was like, sort of generations after the fact, to see what the modern world looked like, to see where are these differences sort of new, different, more complicated, what progress has been made. And I thought, I'll just read a couple of the blurbs if you don't mm-hmm. mind. So this opens up with, as up to the minute as a Kendrick Lamar track and as ruefully steeped in eternal truths as a Gogol tale, these stories mark the debut of an assured young talent and American storyteller. Bound together by shared experience but pulled apart by their changing fortunes, four young friends growing up in the post-industrial enclave of Pawtucket, Rhode Island, struggle to liberate themselves from the legacies left of them as black men in America. With potent immediacy and bracing candor, this provocative debut follows a decade in the lives of Dub, Rolls, Rye, and Geo as they grapple with the complexity of their family histories, the allure of sex and drugs, and the ferocity of their desires. Geo proves himself an unforgettable narrator, beautifully flawed and unstintingly honest, as he recounts his friend's triumphs and failures, whether it's a family cookout gone wrong, a raucous night in high society Manhattan turned dark, or the troubled efforts of a hustler to go legit. J.M. Holmes brings the thump and heat of his scenes to life with the kind of ease that makes us not just eavesdroppers, but participants. And it's the eavesdropping into what seems like normal life that, to me, is the approximation of an experience that is not my own mm-hmm. that I'm looking forward to read. How Are You Going to Save Yourself illuminates in breathtaking detail an entire world, one that has been underrepresented in American fiction. At times funny, often uncomfortable, occasionally disturbing, these stories fearlessly engage with issues of race, sex, drugs, class, and family. Holmes's blistering and timely new voice, richly infused with the unmistakable rhythms of hip-hop that form the soundtrack to his characters' lives, delivers on indelible fiction that has never been more vital and necessary. I don't know exactly the setting in terms of time and place. I know mm-hmm. where it is in Rhode Island, but time. But to me, this is what I consider something that seems like it's similar to my experience. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what growing up in these different pockets with their different backgrounds would read as.
Nice.
I like that one. I suspect you'll find a lot that's similar.
Yeah.
I think that always happens.
David?
Well, of course, I told you I had to go with Parting the Waters.
Which looks like a well-worn copy of Parting the Waters.
A few times. Taylor Branch's book about the civil rights struggle, Pulitzer Prize winning. It is very, very depressing reading this book because, not because of the subject matter, but because I know I'll never write anything as consequential as this. It's not going to happen. So it's very but I wanted to read it very briefly. If I have 90 seconds.
Of course.
I wanted to read the sections from early in the book. This book is 800 pages. It's very, very detailed. It's amazing, the detail, the Taylor.
Yeah, the research.
It's incredible. Anyway, this is about the Montgomery boycott, mm-hmm. the bus boycott, 1955. And I just don't think people understand how young Martin Luther King was. He was 38. Well, he was 38 when he died. But he was 26 when he started the Montgomery boycott, mm-hmm. bus boycott. He was 26 years old.
When he thought he was tapped out.
Yeah. And had, you know, wasn't really sure what his life's mission was going to be. He could have gone in a lot of different directions. He could have he could have been a preacher like his father and been a very mm-hmm. successful one in Atlanta or wherever they wanted to be. And could have done that because he had the gift. but he, you know, started reading Niebuhr and all these people, all these nonviolent people, and started thinking mm-hmm. about Gandhi and what Gandhi talked about in terms of nonviolent protests, and really kind of just changed everything. So the bus boycott starts in late 1955. So this is early January of 1956, which is just before his 27th birthday. Now, of course, what happened during the boycotts was, because people were boycotting the buses and not taking the buses, they were arranging for all of the black workers to get rides to and from mm-hmm. wherever they were going. And of course, the Montgomery police and city council and all of those nice, wonderful people at the time decided that they would try to end the boycott by simply issuing traffic tickets for everything. One woman got 27 tickets for doing nothing, essentially. So Dr. King was part of this. He was driving people to and from their work and got stopped one day for no reason and got arrested for no reason. And it was the first time he had ever been arrested. And he was, again, 26 years old, and he was being taken to the jail. He did not know the city that well in terms of the geography. And when he was being taken out on what he thought were all these country roads, he thought, oh my God, they're not taking me to jail. They're going to kill me. They're going to lynch me. They're going to throw. Then he saw a river and thought they're going to throw me in the river. They're going to tie it like Emmett Till, who had just been killed months earlier, the same way. And it turns out they were actually taking him to the Birmingham jail where he spent the night, and he got bailed out. The next morning, of course, all of the people involved in the boycott, all of the well-meaning African-American citizens, bombarded him with phone calls. Are you okay? What do you need? What do you need? And it just, it was the moment where it could have ended.
Mm-hmm.
It was too much. It was so much. He was getting calls every night, dozens of calls from people who would call and say the most vile, awful things about him and his family and hang up. So he was dealing with that. And then the phone would ring and it would be somebody saying, are you okay? Can we help you? And it was somebody saying, we need you. Don't give up. We need you. We got to. And it just, I just want to read this passage where someone again called a well-meaning person, one of the black workers trying to see if he was going to stick. And Branch says, there was no idea nor imaginable heart large enough to satisfy all of them or to contain them. The limitless potential of a young king, free to think anything and therefore to be anything, was constricted in realities that paralyzed and defined him. King buried his face in his hands at the kitchen table. He admitted to himself that he was afraid, that he had nothing left, that the people would falter if they looked to him for strength. Then he said as much out loud. He spoke the name of no deity, but his doubt spilled out as a prayer, ending, I've come to the point where I can't face it alone. As he spoke these words, the fear suddenly began to melt away. He became intensely aware of what he called an inner voice, telling him to do what he thought was right. Such simplicity worked miracles, bringing a shudder of relief and the courage to face anything. It was for King the first transcendent religious experience of his life. The moment lacked the splendor of a vision or of a voice speaking out loud, as Vernon John said they did, but such differences could be ascribed to rhetorical license. For King, the moment awakened and confirmed his belief that the essence of religion was not a grand metaphysical idea, but something personal, grounded in experience, something that opened up mysteriously beyond the predicaments of human beings in their frailest and noblest moments. I'm never going to write anything that good. I'm never going to write sentences that good. That's amazing.
I think it's brilliant, not just because of how it's written, but because how it captures such an important moment in his life.
Yeah, that was it. It was sink or swim. It was go, no go.
Yeah.
Comfortable life or lead the life that you know is going to lead to your death.
Yeah. And
how do you make that choice at 26?
Well, I don't. I don't want to tell you what I was doing when I was 26. But to your point, he could have chosen, it's not just an easy path, but he could have just followed in his father's footsteps, even though I learned today that he got a C in public speaking when he was in school. But he could have had and very admirable life following his father's footsteps. Absolutely. But he decided to take a much, much harder path.
Yeah.
That's great. Jamie, do you have?
So my first thought when you...
I didn't give you this homework assignment.
No, I know. But your first thought when you mentioned this was Eyes on the Prize by
John
Williams, which was also a PBS series. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about it more, though, and I remember... I was thinking back to the year was 2000. I was traveling with Defense Secretary William Cohen and his wife, and they went to visited Cape Town, South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a visit to Robben Island. Where Nelson Mandela spent years in prison. And while I was there, I picked up a copy of his book, Letters from Prison by Nelson Mandela. And that would be my pick.
That's a good one.
Good call.
It's not in the United States, but it's, you know, his struggle against apartheid. And it's, I don't have it here to read an excerpt from it, but it was, it, had a real effect on me.
Yeah. I don't know if it still is true there. I'm looking at the undisclosed location bartender, Brian. We went with another family and our kids, and we went to Robbins Island, and we're having this wonderful, it's remarkable, and you're having this tour, this wonderful older gentleman who knew everything and just gave the tour with the greatest feeling and empathy and detail. And you don't know until the tour ends that he had been held a prisoner there. I got that right? Yeah, it was remarkable. That's a bucket list kind of thing.
By the way, while we were there, Cohen's wife wanted to actually meet Nelson Mandela, who was still alive.
Uh-huh.
And we took a long trip out to some remote location and knocked on the door, and there he was.
Did he answer the door?
He did.
How great is
he
that?
He answered the door himself.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing moment. I'll never forget.
That's got to be the best story we're going to get tonight.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah. I can't top any of this. But Michael, to your point, I was thinking about the last 49 episodes of the show, and we've had some pretty remarkable people on. Scott Price's book, Playing Through the Whistle, is ostensibly about a couple of teams outside Pittsburgh, but it really is about race and how that is still a problem there. We had Will Haygood, Tope Falerne, Chris Wilson. Chris was just remarkable. And I think the thing that just keeps coming to me is unfinished business.
Right.
And that's what Claiborne Carson talked about in the interview. And I just can't stop thinking about what Martin Luther King think now. Right? What would he think now? And I think it's got to be enormous frustration because it's unfinished business.
Didn't Kellyanne Conway speculate on this today?
Yes, of course. Noted King.
Of course she did.
I don't think it would be all bad. I know that's kind of the default. I get it. I understand why people feel that way. But I think a black man in 1968 who was coming through time travel to 2020 would go,
yeah,
oh my God.
Yeah, who stop and then get dropped back into society in 2020.
I think about my dad all the time. My dad is a man of his time.
Yes.
And he just, even though he's still, God bless me, still here, but his mindset is that of a man who grew up in segregated America.
Yeah.
I can't fathom what it was like to be him. I have no reference, frame of reference for that. And so, Martin Luther King grew up in that America. So what he sees now, I think his mind would be blown. Yeah. Now, he would still say, hey, there's still a lot we got to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can I just interject? Because when I mentioned Senator Cohen, who became the defense secretary under Bill Clinton, I mentioned his wife, but I didn't mention her name. Janet Langhart Cohen.
Yeah.
And Secretary Cohen obviously was in an interracial marriage.
Yes.
And during this trip, Janet Langhart Cohen made a point of coming back and talking to all of us in the press about the importance she thought about the whole visit to Robben Island. I just wanted to make sure I didn't mention him and not mention her.
And she did a great interview, which you can see on C-SPAN, with Dr. Carson. Great interview. And share some stories. She worked with, at some point, might have been an internship-like thing, Martin Luther King Jr. Remarkable story in and of herself.
She is fascinating.
The last word.
Well, I'm sort of flailing here because I want to be part of this desert island thing. And it's not because I've read a particularly amazing nonfiction about the civil rights era, but in terms of the resonance, in terms of books that sort of show it in relief that are more modern, I have a few fiction and nonfiction. I have to recommend Sing Unburied Sing by Jesmond Ward, which is an amazing, amazing book that, again, that and, Colson Whitehead, I just finished the Nickel Boys. I was kind of late to that one.
Great book.
Nickel Boy, and that's a little different because that's like historical fiction, but it was so well done, so moving. Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me, a couple authors we featured at the last book festival. Damon Young has a nonfiction essay book called What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, which was absolutely a knockout book. Getting into fiction short stories, Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, it's a mouthful, I realize, had a great book called Friday Black. And another author we featured, and another another event was Chimamanda Adichie, who has the immigrant Americana. She's a Nigerian immigrant, mm-hmm, one of my favorite authors, and her book Americana was sort of told the tale of immigrants coming to the United States, but African immigrants, but also with keen observations on the sort of American situation. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful, wonderful book. So I recommend all of those books.
Claire's going to be losing her mind. Claire Lentola, you're listening. Thank you so much, because she keeps track of all the books we recommend. Yeah. And they're great recommendations. Thanks, everybody. So that is it for us. Claude, thanks for making everything happen this evening, as ever. The most important man in the room. 50. Mayor, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you. Jamie, not Bill Curtis, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Chatter on Books. If you've enjoyed tonight's podcast, please recommend it to your friends and get it wherever you get your podcasts.
Exactly. I'm supposed to say those things more often. Please download these. Please review us kindly. Those who review us do review us very kindly, but keep doing that. Send us any questions, ideas, author ideas, segment ideas to info@chatteronbooks.com. David, Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next week, I was a little upset when I said at Calvert Woodley today because, again, Michael was on his way to the Bordeaux tasting, but Stephen and Bill did not seem aware that this time next week we will be taping this show at Calvert Woodley. Okay, it's our pre Super Bowl show.
Not a lot of space.
Not a lot of space. We'll be very cozy.
Where were you planning to tape this?
I was
taping at the La Cheeserie counter. It is just a counter.
Michael actually ruled that out because that's where the most customers are.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want us there blocking customers. So we'll be over kind of in the beer section.
Exactly.
And we're going
to
do
this to your car.
We're going to do some of the Michael Sands backstory and Stephen Fatsis. Am I pronouncing that correctly,
yes,
David?
That's right.
Yeah, who is a fabulous guy, who's sort of the George Plimpton of our era.
Wrote a great book.
He tried to be a punter in the NFL.
Kicker. He did very well, actually.
A few minutes of panic, I think, is what it's called. And he has turned into a competitive Scrabble player. He wrote a book about Scrabble. Well, he himself has become a competitive Scrabble player. Yeah. And so we will have him on the show. So thank you all very much. Have a great Martin Luther King Day and beyond. And we'll see you next week.